16, audio 7.70.
Another edition of American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks as the G8 leaders are meeting right now in Scotland. Staring at the sun. Yes, they're staring at ways to decrease greenhouse gas emissions, which means they want to restrict your development. Make no mistake about that. The only way that you're going to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions is by restricting industry. And the only reason you would want to restrict industry is to plunge populations of people into poverty. And they're talking about eliminating poverty in Africa, and that is nothing less than socialism done on a worldwide scale. And that's what's been going on ever since the United Nations has come into being. The United Nations is a socialist entity, and the U.S. government is working hand-in-hand with the United Nations to build countries around the world that have been living in poverty for years, to bring them out of poverty so that their basic human needs will be met. And the key word there, of course, being basic. This is American Exposé. I'm Darren Wiggs. This is the July 8th, 2005 edition of the broadcast. And welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We have some information that we're going to be sharing with you about oil, as oil has topped $61 a barrel, at least, at this point in time. And from the Christian Science Monitor here, we see oil energy forecast. Oil supplies grow. That's right. We're being told on every hand that we have an oil shortage, that we have an energy shortage, and yet the reality is, as we've been telling you time and time again, there is no shortage of energy. There is no shortage of oil. The oil shortage is a created crisis, ladies and gentlemen. That's just the way it is. And the Christian Science Monitor comes out with this information by Ron Shearer. He writes, according to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, the end is near. When the Earth's oil reserves start to run dry and scarce petroleum will go to the highest bidder. Seers have written books detailing that time, and websites such as EnergyShortage.com forecast a steady rise in prices, such as Tuesday's oil price of more than $59 a barrel. And of course, this was dated back a while, the June 22nd, so it's as I said, it's topped $61 a barrel. At one point, it was forecast to go up to $70 a barrel. Now, they say here, not so fast, maintains a new report issued Tuesday by the widely respected group Cambridge Energy Research Associates, or CERA. Instead of the wells running dry, CERA says petroleum supplies will be expanding faster than new demand over the next 5 years, according to an analysis oil field by oil field. In good news for the SUV set, the new oil will be light, sweet crude, ideal for making gasoline. And since supply will grow, CERA forecasts that prices will fall, possibly below $40 a barrel. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I would suggest to you here that what they're saying here about the oil is true, but their forecast for the $40 a barrel oil, that it's going to continue, the prices are actually going to fall. Never underestimate the power of the globalists having a desire to create the crisis and use that. Because I don't believe that, I don't think they want oil to go down. Populations are too easily to control when there's created this problem. Peter Jackson, a co-author of the report, says, quote, "We expect supply to outpace demand growth in the next few years, which would take the pressure off prices around 2007 to 2008 or thereafter, and even lead to a period of price weakness." Unquote. Kjell Aklit, a professor of physics in Sweden and president of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, says the CERA report is overly optimistic. In addition, he says one of his students looked at a draft of the report and concluded the CERA double counted. He said from his cell phone in Madrid, "I'm not worried about this report." Well, why would you be worried about a positive report, Professor, unless you're a Marxist and you want your Marxist agenda put in place, and this report would get in the way of your Marxist agenda? That's the question I ask. It's funny how he chooses these particular words. "I'm not worried about this report." Almost like it's bad news, you know? He says, over the next several years, they will find new oil fields, but then it will be hard to do it. What does this Marxist professor know that he's keeping here from us? Isn't that amazing that he almost seems to thrive on the bad on the good news and hope for the bad news? I said that backwards, but we'll go on. Still, CERA maintains that higher prices are encouraging production and that the technology is helping to capture oil from older fields. It foresees non-OPEC production expanding rapidly through the rest of the decade, particularly as new supplies come on stream from Russia, the Caspian, Brazil, Angola, and Canada. Continuing here, they say much of the production increase is already starting to happen as oil-rich nations begin to dig deeper and produce faster. According to the report, there are approximately 20 to 30 new major projects producing more than 75,000 of barrels per day, coming on stream every year until 2010. These will add 3 million to 4 million barrels of oil per day each year. Over the next 5 years, there will be 10 million barrels per day of new light or medium crude and 3 million barrels per day of new heavy crude. Altogether, supply will exceed demand by 6 million to 7.5 million barrels per day later in the decade, according to CERA. While many of the oil depletion theories claim that Saudi production will falter, CERA predicts that the oil-rich nation will expand its production by as much as 2 million barrels of oil per day by 2010. In fact, the CERA analysis concludes that OPEC production will expand the fastest to 45.6 million barrels per day, up from 36.8 million last year. But because of political uncertainty, it has shaved its estimates for oil production from Russia. Any decline of Russian crude production would also be mirrored by a continued decline in production from other non-OPEC countries, such as the United States. And see, the point here is no matter how much oil that we have, if you don't refine the oil, you can't use the oil. And the problem is we don't have refineries. We have limited refinery capacity in this country, as I've been saying over and over on this broadcast. And there's a reason why these people want to make us energy dependent. There is a reason why they want to keep energy prices higher and have them go higher all the time. The point is to discourage you from driving your automobile. to get you to ride a bike instead. See, all of this is related to the G8 summit that's going on right now in Scotland. All of this nonsense about greenhouse gases causing global warming. It's junk science, there's no scientific proof, and yet I heard on the BBC last week how George W. Bush, who's supposedly been heralded by these Republican neocon idiots, George W. Bush, he's out there standing up for our liberty. He's fighting the environmentalists. George W. Bush bringing some sense to the whole environmental perspective, looking out for American industry. Yeah, George W. Bush, the hero, help is on the way. It's George W. Bush with the cape. Well, George W. Bush admitted, I shouldn't say admitted, he came out and made the statement that human beings were at least in part to blame for global warming. Now, ladies and gentlemen, to make a statement like that proves what we've been saying all along, that there is no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. They're two heads of the same beast working in tandem for the mutual destruction of the country. For George W. Bush to come out and make that statement shows exactly what we've been saying all along, that there's no difference. And that's the reality of it. Because there is no scientific evidence that human beings are causing global warming. And to base your policy of reducing, to make the statement, to suggest that human beings need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which means that you're going to have to quit driving your automobiles, it means factories are going to have to quit producing as many goods, it means less wealth. That's the bottom line. There's no other way around it. So, here we see, from some publication called The Argus, I don't know where this is based, but the headline is, wind farms pitch plan to address bird deaths. Now, wind farms are a so-called solution that's produced by environmentalists as a clean energy solution. Now, wind farms have their own problems in the first place. When it comes to energy production, you have to have a lot of wind in order for wind farms to work. So you can't place wind farms everywhere and have them be beneficial. There has to be a high wind area in the first place. But another problem is they tend to chop up a lot of birds, including endangered ones. And now we have a situation where that is happening. It says wind farm operators in the Altamont Pass are offering to shut down half of their electricity producing windmills during the winter to reduce bird deaths and to replace them all with more modern machines within 13 years. There's that Masonic number again, by the way, 13. But the proposal, which Alameda County officials will consider Thursday, comes with strings attached. The offer is good only if an environmental group drops its lawsuit over the deaths of thousands of birds. So these environmentalists, they urge for the thing to be put there in the first place. And this is, of course, environmentalists at the UN, I'm sure. And it's being fed down through the State Department, non-governmental organizations. Why do they have these windmills here in the first place? Because, well, the environmental groups, both in and out of government. Then they chop up a bunch of birds, and who sues but the environmental groups? It's just remarkable, isn't it, the insanity that goes on? The Center for Biological Diversity says it won't drop the suit it filed against wind farm operators in November because their plan to reduce bird deaths doesn't go far enough. The lawsuit is the only leverage we have, they say, to force wind farm operators and county officials to tackle the problem of bird deaths, said Jeff Miller, a group spokesman. In a June 24th decision, the judge hearing the case declined to dismiss it, and it could go on to trial in the fall. A California Energy Commission study estimated wind turbines in the Alamont kill 881 to 1,300 birds, and of course you got the 13 in there again, a year, including as many as 116 federally protected golden eagles. Uh-huh. So here you see a situation they created, and now what are they going to do but sue in answer to their solution, which creates more problems. Such circular idiocy, and it's all for what reason? The bottom line is it's all to cripple the American economy. It's all to drive all of you into poverty. They're not going to be happy until the average American is not able to keep the lights on and not able to keep themselves warm in the winter and cool in the summer. And that's the bottom line. If you can't put food on your table, that's when they'll be happy. Miller said the county could impose conditions that would cut bird deaths in half almost immediately. To accomplish that goal, he said, all of the wind turbines in the Altamont would need to be idled from mid-November through February. Another 350 machines that kill a disproportionate number of birds would have to be permanently scrapped, the center maintained, citing similar conclusions by biologists studying the issue for the Energy Commission. In addition to taking wind turbines out of service, the center wants the companies that operate them to pay $6.5 million to preserve bird habitats in the Altamont. Wind farm operators are willing to shut down only half their turbines each winter. And what's that going to do? It's going to cut energy production. That's what it's designed to do. It's just amazing to me, folks. They agreed to shut down half their turbines each winter and permanently shut down or relocate about 100 turbines that pose the greatest risk to birds. The plan they have put forward to county officials commits to a 35% reduction in bird deaths within 3 years. If the county places too many conditions on their operations, wind farm operators say they won't be profitable. Well, gee, could that be the goal? I ask. They say we've gone as far as we can go. And there you go. So here you have a case where the environmentalists, it seems very obvious to me that the idea is to end energy production. And there's only one reason why they'd want to do that. Moving along here, there's a lot of other things going on, and I'm going to cover the G8 a little more detail later on in the broadcast. But we had John Hamill on Monday's broadcast, and for those of you who missed that, that'll be in the archives. But Dr. Carolyn Dean writes in NewsWithViews.com, June 19, 2005, the U.S. delegation to CODEX has just issued a formal written statement to the Codex Alimentarius Commission that the United States, during the July 4th to 9th, 2005 meeting in Rome, will support compulsory rules created by this international organization directly overruling U.S. law regarding access to vitamins. Now, folks, we covered on Monday's broadcast with John Hamill that they adopted those compulsory rules, this commission that met in Rome this past week, or actually it was before Monday. I think it was Monday that they actually adopted the rules. She says the U.S. law that is about to be vanquished is the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. Again, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. Also known in this document as the DSHEA. Once again, Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. Codex is a joint venture between the United Nations World Health Organization and Food and Agriculture Organization, the WHO and the FAO. Now, the World Trade Organization has already stated that it will enforce Codex guidelines as the world standard for trade in dietary supplements. This will mean that gradually, pill by pill, our access to the dietary supplements we depend on will disappear. For those not familiar with the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, it was passed because 2.5 million ordinary citizens wanted to make sure that dietary supplements such as herbs, vitamins, minerals, and other food-based supplements could stay on the over-the-counter market. Movement to create this law, known as the DSHEA, started when a 1992 FDA task force published a report announcing the FDA's desire to remove these products from the shelves as they represented a, quote, disincentive for patented drug research, unquote. See, the idea here, ladies and gentlemen, is to empower the drug companies all the more, because the drug companies aren't making anything that's going to get you well. Drugs tend to deal with symptoms. They deal with symptoms more often than not. Drugs will take away pain. Drugs will address certain things. But the thing that you really need to get healed, you cannot have health without vitamins, without minerals, without nutrients. You have to have proper nutrients or you cannot get well. I don't care how many drugs you have. That's the bottom line. Without your ability to take vitamins and minerals, you do not have any ability to keep from getting sick. Now, why would these people want to control your vitamins and minerals and make you sick? Immediately following this announcement, the announcement that the FDA had a desire to remove these products from the shelves, as they represented a disincentive for patented drug research. Following that announcement, millions of Americans learned about how famed vitamin Dr. Jonathan Wright's patient-filled medical office was raided by the same month, in the same month, by nearly 24 gun-toting, flak-jacketed FDA agents in the name of regulating supplements. Battering down an unlocked office door, these agents, backed by burly sheriff's department deputies, lined up staff and patients against the wall, pulled IVs from patients' arms in middle of treatments, confiscated patient records, took the hard drive from the office computer, and all this was done because Dr. Jonathan Wright was using nutritional supplements to heal very sick people who could not get help from standard allopathic medical care. As the story developed, it turned out that this Gestapo-style raid was standard operating procedure for the FDA, and as the general public became aware of just how many doctors' offices, manufacturing companies, distributors, and health food stores had been assaulted by similar raids, the horror of all this forged a mighty health freedom army that resulted in unanimous passage of DSHEA. The idea was twofold. Number one, DSHEA was to make clear distinction between food, which was considered generally safe and did not need to have permission from the FDA to be allowed on the market, and drugs, which are generally toxic, potentially deadly, and in need of lengthy evaluation before they were available to the public under prescription from a doctor. Number two, the second idea of the law was that DSHEA provides the FDA with plenty of legal authority to remove herbs or dietary supplements from the market, providing the agency has plenty of real evidence of real harm to the public. The FDA also has the authority to limit the amount of a supplement to low levels if the agency has plenty of real evidence to prove higher levels are actually dangerous. The FDA and its big pharma backers have never liked DSHEA because these products and the related natural healing arts services often related to them are putting the allopathic drug, surgical, and chemical medical industry to shame. She says, in my book, Death by Modern Medicine, using allopathic medical industry's own official report, she says, I document how 784,000 people die every year in the American medical system while following doctors' orders in a highly regulated allopathic system. The proof that dietary supplements and the practitioners who promote them are safe and work as expected is evidence everywhere. Studies conducted all over the world have shown that supplements are actually safer than food, and there is simply no hard evidence to show that there is any risk factor worthy of discussion, much less needing universal risk assessment. Yet the U.S. delegation, along with its big pharma backers, are bound and determined that Codex force risk analysis assessments upon the American dietary supplement industry so that they can bypass the expressed will of the American people. She says the real reason for promotion of risk assessment is based on two agendas. First, to be able to strip the over-the-counter marketplace of everything but low-quality, low-dose-level products that won't do much to support or improve health. Second, to set up the framework to allow Big Pharma to take over the supplement market as a new form of drugs where prices can be jacked up outrageously and doled out by doctors for a fee. Understand this, she says. If you do not act now, you and everyone you love will be condemned to living under an international law that denies your basic right to maintain your health. And without health, you have no freedom. Like private property rights. Without private property rights, you have no freedom. And we certainly have had our private property rights blown away by the Supreme Court and by other means. Now, there's still hope on the state level. I don't want you to forget that, ladies and gentlemen. The state levels, the states have their own constitutions. And we need to work with state lawmakers to, like never before, to urge them, if there's not provisions in your state constitution, to preserve your private property rights against eminent domain threats, then you need to work with your lawmakers and get that inserted into your state constitutions. Because otherwise, what chance do we have? Otherwise, there will be nobody in America who has a house, who has a place. Anytime any company comes along that wants your house, they'll take it. We have numerous measures in place in the countryside, endangered species, all the sustainable development garbage that comes down from the UN through the State Department and through non-governmental organizations like the Nature Conservancy to take away your house and your property in the country. And then we have eminent domain and outrageous private property taxes, taxes in the city, development, private developers taking your land. All of this connects. All of this boils down to a loss of freedom in this country, and we have to spread this message so that other people wake up and go, and a lot of them know what's going on. A lot of them are aware that there's a problem. They're aware that they're no longer living in the free country. And that is very vital, to take advantage and exploit the doubting that people have today. We have to take a break here, ladies and gentlemen. I have another piece about vitamins I'm going to share with you on the other side of the break about what happened. And the headline of this piece is Vitamins to be Banned Worldwide. Stay with us. We'll be back on the other side of the break.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at FirstAmendmentRadio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25. Or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. You may also adopt an hour of your favorite program. Please don't forget that most of the programs on FirstAmendmentRadio.com are listener-supported. Don't do Internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Hear that? That's the sound of nearly 3 million American jobs being flushed down the toilet. What caused it? NAFTA. 10 years ago, Congress passed NAFTA. It was supposed to boost our economy. Instead, we lost millions of jobs and the nation is still hurting. But now Congress is quietly considering doing it again, but worse this time. By creating a free trade area of the Americas, also called the FTAA. This would outsource millions more American jobs and businesses. How can our country survive this devastation again? Learn how you can help. Visit www.stoptheftaa.org or call 1-800-JBS-USA1. Log on to our website and let Congress know that you think FTAA is not an option for America's future. Stoptheftaa.org and keep American jobs in America.
Small town boy, nothing special about me seemed ever goes like it didn't happen. You came walking in my door, oh, your sweet loving hand is begging for. I ain't got a lot of money, I got a lot of love for you.
Continent of Africa, and that's why the G8 leaders are there in Scotland discussing how to bring them out of poverty. And ladies and gentlemen, make no mistake about it, no matter what solution, quote unquote, they come up with, you're going to end up paying for it. And that's just the way it goes with international socialism under the banner of the United Nations and equality for all. The bottom line is, if a country is in poverty, or a continent even, the reason it's in poverty is because it's got bad government. And that's what it all boils down to, as Maletsky Mbeki writes. This person says, as the G8 summit approaches, and the leaders of the developed world contemplate huge increases in aid to Africa, we must ask ourselves what has become of the billions of dollars already poured into that continent. Africa remains wracked by poverty and disease, while other formal colonial outposts in East Asia are booming. At the root of Africa's problems are ruling political elites that have squandered the continent's wealth and choked its productivity over the last 40 years. Yeah, these are the people, folks, that we're getting ready to give a whole lot of money to and to forgive their debt. The list of abuses is long and impressive. African political elites have systematically exploited their positions in order to line their own pockets. They have given favors and won influence through the funding of huge loss-making industrialization projects. They have exploited the natural resources of their countries and then transferred profits, taxes, and aid funds into their own foreign bank accounts. At the same time, they ran up enormous debts to finance their government's operations. What were the results of those predatory policies? According to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which have become Africa's fairy godparents, Africans are poor and getting poorer. The World Bank noted, quote, despite gains in the second half of the 1990s, sub-Saharan Africa enters the 21st century with many of the world's poorest countries. Average per capita income is lower than at the end of the 1960s. Incomes, assets, and access to essential services are unequally distributed. And the region contains a growing share of the world's absolute poor, who have little power to influence the allocation of resources, unquote. Now, folks, we're quoting directly from the World Bank here, okay? So you can't just chalk this up to just say, well, you're just against the whole... No, this is the World Bank talking. This division is made easier by the modern African state, which in most countries was created by European imperial powers that had little regard for ethnic and religious differences, among Africans. From the early days of independence, competing and antagonistic groups were forced together in the political process. The political elites that took over the African countries in the 1960s thus saw government as a source of power and personal enrichment. The region's political leaders have been enriching themselves so ever since. Successful development in Africa will not be achieved by throwing more fuel on the flames. Merely handing more aid money to African governments only reinforces the pattern of abuse. The key to development lies in a dynamic private sector. For a country to produce more, private individuals must generate savings and plow those savings back into the production process in the form of new and improved techniques, processes, and products. Africa's private sector is predominantly made up of peasants, and to a lesser extent, subsidiaries of foreign-owned multinational corporations. But those groups are exploited and bullied by the unproductive political elites who control the state. Africa's private sector is powerless because it is not free to decide what happens to its savings. Case in point, African political elites use their control of the state to extract that region's agricultural surplus, where the peasants free to retain that surplus capital, they could invest it in improving their production techniques or diversifying their economic activities. Instead, the political elites are using marketing boards and taxation to divert those savings to finance their own consumption and strengthen the repressive instruments of the state. The more the African political elites consolidate power, and the more they tighten their grip on the reins of the state, the more the peasants are likely to become poorer, and the more African economies are likely to regress or stagnate. See, the bottom line is here, folks, throwing more money at the problem is not going to solve anything. If they're poor, they're poor for a reason. And until you deal with the reason that they're poor in the first place, giving them more money is not going to solve anything. But never let reality get in the way of a socialist dream of utopia. They continue here. They say a most striking case of that phenomenon is Nigeria. According to a study of Nigeria by the Center of the Study of African Economies at Oxford, between 1980 and 2000 per capita, gross domestic product in 1996 dollars adjusted for purchasing power parity fell from $1,215 to $706, a 40% drop. The number of Nigerians living below the poverty line increased from 19 million in 1970 to $90 million in 2000. That was accompanied by a massive rise in inequality. In 1970, the top 2% of the population earned the same income as the bottom 17%. By 2000, the income of the top 2% equaled that of the bottom 55%. Now, what we covered over the past week here was the fact that how much money that Nigeria has squandered. Basically, in the last 40 years, that country's leaders have squandered the total amount, a dollar amount equivalent to the total amount of aid that has been given by the West to the African continent. That one country has squandered, and yet we're going to give them more. It's never enough. The United States and the other developed countries are not doing enough to alleviate African poverty, ladies and gentlemen. And by the way, I know I haven't been living under a rock. I'm fully aware of the so-called terrorist attack that happened in London. I have not mentioned it because, frankly, what else can you say about it other than the fact that it's undoubtedly orchestrated by the same jerks that are over there in Scotland meeting to discuss how to alleviate African poverty, while they do everything they can to plunge the rest of the world into poverty. It's just amazing the lies and deception that go forward on a daily basis. And more people are dying because we have to prove that terrorism is still a threat. At any rate, continuing here, they say, future development in Africa requires a new type of democracy. No, how about we try a different type of government? Something that doesn't have to do with socialism. Democracy is socialism. And you'll never get by spreading democracy. You're never going to have a healthy anything when you have a democracy. But they say it requires a new type of democracy, one that empowers not just the political elite, but private sector producers as well. It is necessary that peasants, who constitute the core of the private sector, become the real owners of their primary asset, and that is land. See, democracy doesn't give you the ability to own and control your own land. Democracy takes away from your private property rights. As an Army training manual once pointed out, back in the day when we actually had a little intelligence in this country, and we weren't dumbing down the entire population, back when people actually cared a little bit about their individual liberty. They continue. They say private ownership of land would not only generate wealth, but help to check rampant deforestation and accelerating desertification. The so-called communal land tenure system, which is really state ownership of land, ought to be abolished. Moreover, peasants need direct access to world markets. The producers must be able to auction their own cash crops rather than be forced to sell them to state-controlled marketing boards. Africa needs new financial institutions that are independent of political elite and can address the financial needs not only of peasants, but of small to medium scale producers as well. In addition to providing financial services, those institutions could undertake all of the other technical services that are not being provided at present by African governments, such as crop research, extension services, livestock improvement, storage, transportation, and distribution to make agriculture more productive. Such changes could, for the first time, bring into being a genuine market economy that answers to the needs of African producers and consumers. African governments currently acknowledge the role of good governance in stimulating economic growth. However, they are still doing little to address the fundamental problem of the enormous imbalance between the political elite and private sector producers. African governments must spend more time addressing that problem rather than impressing foreign governments, including those of the G8, with inflated accounts of democratization on the continent. Well, you know, the bottom line is we're just going to go ahead and throw more money at the problem. Now, this whole terrorist situation, this is just more manipulation of the people. That's the bottom line. The timing of this thing, even as they're meeting to discuss how to do these noble things like eliminate poverty worldwide and to address these climate change issues, which human beings have nothing to do with, by the way. But as they're trying to deal with these world problems, all these evil boogeymen, these evil terrorists strike again. Oh no, we're in a bad situation. That's right. It's time for another witch hunt, ladies and gentlemen.
But again, I want to tell the American people, we're doing everything we can at home, but you better have a president who chases these terrorists down and bring them to justice before they hurt us again. Everybody looks at the new bandwagon in town. We must deal with threats before they fully materialize. Hop on the board and let the wind carry you around. And the other lesson is that there are people who can't stand what America stands for and desire to inflict great harm on the American people. We cannot let terrorists and rogue nations hold this nation hostile or hold our allies hostile.
Fact.
This is a global effort. We're facing
Yeah, spit it out, George. Andres Carter writes about the absolute idiocy of the idea of these videotapes coming out all the time. You know, they talk a lot about Osama bin Laden releasing these videotapes and these things airing on Al Jazeera. And this person writes, imagine this scene from the distant caves of Afghanistan, Osama Studios, periodically producing self-incriminating videos of Osama bin Laden threatening America with doom and destruction. Al-Qaeda operatives then leave the cave and drop the video in the nearest mailbox out in the desert to be delivered to Al Jazeera TV station, which will in turn broadcast the video to the whole world. We have all heard stories about these timely videos that find their way to Al Jazeera offices during critical periods, such as the American presidential elections. Of course, the stories sound quite logical to the fools who learn their history and geography from Fox Network or by watching Walt Disney movies. After all, to these creatures, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Al Jazeera land refer to the same general piece of property, perhaps south of Mexico or somewhere over yonder. But the reality is a little different. Afghanistan is a landlocked country, meaning it is surrounded not by any mass of water, but by countries such as Pakistan, Iran, and Tajikistan. Always have trouble pronouncing those Middle Eastern countries. Al Jazeera Network is based in a country called Qatar, or Qatar. Qatar is located in the Persian Gulf and up to thousands of kilometers away from Afghanistan. You don't mail packages in Afghanistan by dropping them in the nearest mailbox. To mail packages, you have to go to a city or town with a post office and walk to the counter. The Al Jazeera address will surely draw the attention of the attendant or post office staff. That aside, timeliness and reliability of delivery of packages is unpredictable and generally lacking unless, of course, the organization providing the delivery service is a spook agency, such as the CIA or Saudi intelligence. And what about the websites that post videos of beheadings and clips from Osama or al-Zaghawi? Again, to the uninformed, websites reside somewhere in the clouds in internet land, and thus quite elusive, and the corporate media always attempt to reinforce this illusion. Have you ever noticed they hardly ever provide their readers with the URL? Yeah, isn't that funny how they always tell, they always say an internet address, an internet website, but they never tell you what website it is. So they say, start thinking to yourself, and you'll see reality is something else. All static websites are either registered in a country or hosted by sites that are registered in the country. For example, Yahoo.com has a registration record in Network Solutions databases, meaning it is traceable. Your personal homepage might also be traceable through registration of its domain. If not, it is being hosted by a site such as Yahoo.com, which again will make it quite traceable. You see, the daily bombardment of propaganda can be so effective that even intelligent people who are aware of these facts are still fooled by the news reports. Having said that, it was only recent that the government of the United States arrested and imprisoned Sherman Austin, the owner and operator of a website called RaiseTheFist.com, for posing a bomb-making recipe that was generally available on the Internet. In doing so, Austin got into a heap of trouble with the United States government. Now, this person says, I really would like to know which democratic haven in the Middle East that tolerates websites that post these types of clips. Would it be any of the dictatorships in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, or Uzbekistan? Obviously not. These countries, being puppets of the United World, would probably arrest and behead the operators of such websites. Or in the cases of Uzbekistan, they would be boiled in hot water. How about Afghanistan or Iraq? Obviously, U.S.-occupied countries couldn't be the ones. Israel? Definitely not. Would it be Iran? Iran has been lately trying to polish its image and arresting people on charges of being members of Al-Qaeda. By the way, I want to come back to Israel here for just a moment. I read regarding this terrorist, quote-unquote, terrorist attack in London, that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was warned in advance. That that was an admission in the media yesterday, that Benjamin Netanyahu actually was warned before the so-called terrorist attack. Is this a Mossad operation? That's the question you need to ask. Anyway, the point here, and I'm not going to finish this, but they're kind of having a little fun with this, but the point of the matter is, if there is a website claiming responsibility for these so-called attacks, then why don't they trace it down? There's ways to track everything on the internet. In order to have internet access, in order to have a computer on the, every computer on the internet has an IP address, has an IP number. There is a number. Every time you connect, even if you have dial-up, if you connect to the internet, you have a unique IP number that is traceable some way back to you. That's just the way it is. And sometimes if you have a dial-up account, you are assigned, when you connect to the internet, you're assigned an IP number by your internet provider for the duration of the time that you are connected until you disconnect. And then when you reconnect, you get a different number. But the point is that your internet service provider has logs of who connected with which number, and all of that can be traced so that if you do something illegal online, they know who did it. So if you're running an internet website where you're claiming responsibility for some so-called terrorist attack, some terrorism, you can and will be found out if they want to find out who did it. So all of this stuff about this internet website here claimed responsibility, well, then why don't they go pick them up? Why don't they go get them? Folks, do you see how we're being lied and manipulated all the time? These global spooks must just get together and just laugh at us. Moving along here, from MSNBC, this is just remarkable. Dated July 6, 2005. Dateline Redmond, Washington. It says, quick, why did the grizzly bear cross the road? Yes, just like the chicken in the old joke, he needed to get to the other side. But in these days of 70-mile-per-hour interstates crammed with 2-ton SUVs and semi-trucks, biologists and highway planners have a more urgent question. How the heck is Yogi going to get there? See, in the headline of this piece is, more wildlife getting helped across the highway. Funding, studies, new attitudes combine to push innovative structures. What is their solution? Part of sustainable development is to, and the Wildlands Project, by the way, is to relink wildlife habitats together so that they can have room to roam and the ability to breed. The theory is that wildlife are becoming endangered because they don't have the ability to get together and do their thing, you know, hang out together. And consequently, these habitats have to be linked together. And human beings, with all of their highways and their buildings, have caused these wildlife habitats to be splintered and separated, and now we need to get them all together again. That's the idea. I don't know how in the world they determined all of this, but that's what they think and that's what they say. That's their story and they're sticking to it. They say around the globe, humans are rapidly and radically expanding their efforts to help their wild friends get over and under highways more safely. In the United States, such projects crisscross the map. Washington State to Florida, Massachusetts to Southern California, the furry, feathered, and scaled beneficiaries include everything from elk to turtles. Dr. Jody Hilty, a landscape ecologist with the Bozeman, Montana-based Wildlife Conservation Society, says there is a certain movement out there, and there is certainly is money being spent. You better believe it. A list of U.S. wildlife crossings include increasingly elaborate and expensive projects in a number of states. At the top in scope and cost is a 15-mile expansion along Interstate 90 in the heart of the Washington Cascades. Still in the planning stages, one vision for the 7-year project would incorporate 14 animal passageways. That's right, an overpass for animals. Believe it or not, we're not making this stuff up, folks. I got a picture here. In fact, we'll be posting this on AmericanExpose.com. American spelled with a K, not a C, because you're not going to believe this when you see it, unless you've seen it before. A 56-mile reconstruction of U.S. Highway 93 currently underway between Evarl and Polson, Montana, on the Flathead Indian Reservation includes more than 40 wildlife crossings, adding about $9 million to the $133 million project. 8 alligator underpasses are part of a recently awarded $148 million contract to rebuild 4.5 miles of Highway 1 in the Florida Keys. And Florida, already successful in using crossings to reduce highway deaths of the endangered panthers that roam the Everglades, has now allocated $125,000 to see if a solution can be found to save thousands of turtles from being flattened by cars on U.S. Highway 27 at Lake Jackson near Tallahassee. Ah, man. And this, all of this, by the way, at a time when Americans are struggling to put food on the table, keep the power bill paid, pay the stupid government the taxes on their land, which they shouldn't have to pay extortion on in the first place. And still we have people singing, America, America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, as we engage in Marxism at every front. I want to close with one final thing here. Pennsylvania lawmaker eyes boys' dog seat belt idea. That's right. So now we've taken this ridiculous insanity to the ultimate end. Now we're going to mandate that your dog, your pooch, wears a seatbelt. A state lawmaker is pushing for doggy seatbelts on the advice of an 11-year-old constituent. Mark McCann of Green Tree came up with the idea as part of State Representative Tom Stevenson's annual There Ought to Be a Law contest. Oh, wow. Isn't that great? Stevenson, a Republican from Pennsylvania, submitted a bill to the House Transportation Committee in June that would require drivers to keep their dogs' heads inside the vehicle at all times. Stevenson also wants to require drivers to restrain the animals either with some kind of modified seatbelt or in a crate or carrier box. He says, I never did like dogs sticking their heads out the window. Maybe a sign might have been too close to the road and they'd get hit. Maybe they'd jump out the window on a highway. Believe it or not, he's serious. Stevenson said the bill will protect not only human lives, but pet lives. I think it's going to be a great idea because it's going to cut down on driver distractions. And see, that's what legislators all should be worried about, is dogs sticking their heads out the window and not being properly restrained with a seatbelt. I mean, we've lost our minds in this country. We got to go, folks.
Record budget deficits, bankruptcies galore, and the U.S. dollar is at an all-time low. With today's gloomy economic outlook, safe investments are often hard to find. For over a decade, Melody Cederstrom at Discount Gold and Silver Trading Company has been helping people secure their future by investing in the precious metals. Melody has the honesty, integrity, and experience that is often lacking in the precious metals business. Let her put it to work for you. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 800-374-3900.